This is the Lou Rockwell Show.
I'm delighted today to have Dr. Guido Hulsman for the podcast. Guido's a professor of economics at the University of Angers in France. He's a senior fellow of the Mises Institute, author of a number of books, both in German and in English. His most recent book, I would say his most important book, Mises, The Last Night of Liberalism. But today, Guido, I want to talk to you about what the Federal Reserve and its vassal central banks and England and France and Germany and so forth have done to the world economy, even though in this country prices are going up at a very fast clip. Nobody seems to be concerned about massive inflation of the sort that took place in the 1970s. What do you think we face in terms of economic conditions, whether it's in terms of rising prices, in terms of depression, failing businesses, unemployment? What do we face both in Western Europe and in the United States?
Well, Lou, I'm unfortunately only an economist, not a forecaster and a wisecrack, but I think there are various scenarios that are conceivable if present conditions continue to exist, if the Fed in particular continues its present monetary policy, which is very expansionary and led in cooperation with major foreign central banks, then we are heading effectively a situation of hyperinflation. So prices will grow up very quickly and it will be more difficult for firms to operate in a very rapidly changing environment of prices and relative prices in particular. So prices are not all moving in the same direction at the same speed. And for entrepreneurs, it therefore becomes more difficult to anticipate how will their costs evolve relative to their selling prices and the other way around. So we have to expect in such a case many more business failures, much more unemployment, and much more reduction of aggregate production, so an impoverishment of this population. This is possible if present policies are continued. Of course, we can also imagine other scenarios. If we have a fundamental shift in economic policy, if there's a fundamental return to sound monetary practices, for example, opening the money market up for competition between various types of money, giving consumers free choice of choosing the kind of money they would like to use, or if we simply also decided to back dollar notes again by gold or by silver or any other commodity money, but it would typically be gold or silver, then this too might prevent most of the damage that would otherwise result.
You know, when you say hyperinflation, can you define that? Now, of course, we know, and you might even discuss this, that such things as the consumer price index, the producer price index have got serious flaws. But what do you think we're talking about in terms of prime rate, in terms of the CPI, given, of course, all the government finagling with those statistics? What do you think might be the case if it were hyperinflation?
Hyperinflation is conventionally defined among economists as an increase of the CPI price level of more than 50% per month. That's not a scientific, rigorous definition, if you wish, but it goes back to Philip Kagan, a monetary economist of the 1950s. And his proposal to accept this as a benchmark has been generally accepted by now, so we can work with this as a working definition. And if we reach that level of inflation, increase prices increase in the average by 50% per month, we have a pretty dramatic, a pretty unstable monetary environment. And that's not even a very strong hyperinflation. The hyperinflation that we had in Germany in 1923, for example, was much stronger than this. The hyperinflation that countries like Zimbabwe have right now, or that Yugoslavia had about 15 years ago, were much higher than this. There we reached figures like 500% and even 1,000% per month. And of course, in such a situation, there is a very real possibility that the economy will collapse because people are likely to refuse to be paid in such a money anymore. If the value of the money melts virtually by the minute in your pocket, then you do not want to be paid in such a thing that loses its value without you being able to protect yourself. So people refuse to be paid in such money and they revert to a barter economy. That is, now they demand payment in terms of eggs, in terms of bacon and other things. I show to my students in my class on monetary economics, I show them pictures from the 1923 hyperinflation in Germany where school teachers were paid with coal, hairdressers were paid with eggs. So it was one very funny sign that showed a haircut, four eggs, and shaving a barb, 2 eggs. So such a situation would exist anew. And of course, once we reach such a barter economy, it is no longer possible to make long-standing business plans, to plan for the future, because you are no longer able to calculate your investments, because calculation requires the existence of a generally accepted medium of exchange, which is money.
I remember being in Argentina shortly after the hyperinflation of the 1970s, and the workers at that point had typically been paid every 2 weeks. Then as things got worse, they got paid every week, then every day, then several times a day. And the housewives would line up outside the plant, and the husbands would rush out with their morning pay packet, and the housewives, of course, rushed to try to spend it.
Exactly. In Germany, we had exactly the same thing. So the wives would come with wheelbarrows to the factory gates, and the husband would rush out with huge stacks of paper notes under their arms. They load it all into the wheelbarrow, and the wife then rushes with the wheelbarrow, and she tries to be first among all the other wives to the next grocery shop to spend it as fast as she can.
What happens if, as is already happening in this country, some of the big banks are no longer making the kinds of loans they used to make? They're actually shutting down the number of loans they're making. And of course, some businesses don't want to take loans. How can that affect the Fed's expansionary monetary policy?
Well, if a business is entirely funded by equity, then it does not have to fear from the disappearance of loans. All that happens is that its selling prices will fall, but it can always try to adjust itself on the cost side. That is, can try to push down costs as far as possible. And if that's not possible to a sufficiently low level, it can simply stop operations for a time and wait until business conditions become better. It is a big problem, on the other hand, for companies who are indebted, who operate, and that's the case in many industries, in most industries today, who operate on a high leverage. In that case, if bank credit disappears, we get, of course, the immediate prospect of large-scale company failures and domino effects that result from the fact that the assets of one company are the liabilities of other companies. What would happen in such case, in any case, what is likely to happen and what has happened in the past is that the Fed would step in and create as much money as necessary that it would lend to these companies in difficulty. That's the process that we call bailing out companies. And that, of course, would salvage these companies in the immediate run. It would solve their problems in the short run at the expense of the general population, because the necessary increase in the money supply to finance this general bailout would be so dramatic that prices would explode. So the general consumer would pay indirectly the price, the subsidy that is used to bail out these companies.
I well remember being in the town square of Hillsdale, Michigan, August 15th, 1971, and my whole body being shocked to hear the evil Richard Nixon come on the radio and announce that he was closing the gold window, severing, that is, the last tie between the dollar and gold, and putting on price and wage controls. And he said this was necessary because inflation was running at the very high rate of 6%, and in order to return to a more stable dollar, and to give the American people more honest money, and that was the phrase he used, that he was putting on price and wage controls. Do you think we would face something like that?
Well, apparently even Nixon at the time did not have overly much confidence in this measure, because at the same time he imposed price and wage controls. So the change of the monetary regime all alone does not seem to have led to this consequence that he desired. Today, of course, we no longer have this possibility because we are off the gold standard, so such a measure can no longer be taken. What has taken place in the past in countries that had very high hyperinflation and were on the verge of a collapse of the economy was that they performed a monetary reform. The existing money was replaced by a different new money, but which was still a paper money, with the prospect that the increase of the supply of this new money would not be as strong as the increase of the supply of the old money. It is ultimately a very futile measure because nothing prevents that the new paper money be expended as fast and as dramatically as the old money. So you're playing actually on a psychological trick. You're hoping that the population will mistake the new money for completely different money, whereas, in fact, by its very nature, it stays the same type of paper money as before. And it has worked in a few number of cases, most notably the German monetary reforms of 1923 and 1948. but also similar monetary reforms in Hungary and, well, other countries as well. France also had a monetary reform in 1958, which had introduced a new franc, substituting for the old franc. But again, in the best of all cases, what such reforms do, if they succeed, is that they exploit, so to say, the goodwill of the population and the naivety or ignorance of the population and pave the way for a future simulation very similar to the one that has been mastered or has been solved by this reform. So we had in 1948, we had a currency reform in Germany. 60 years later, well, it's a good span of time, but 60 years later, we are now facing a very strong inflation and running the risk of a hyperinflation in the medium or longer run.
You know, speaking of the ignorance and naivete of the population, what about if the U.S. or Germany or France attempted to impose price and wage controls in response to price increases, of course, blaming everything on businessmen, on or consumers, or anybody but themselves? What's the effect of that?
Well, the effect would be that you create difficulties for business on a large scale, because if you impose wage controls on a certain level, that's one thing. This might be good for companies if you leave selling prices free to move as consumers are willing and able to pay. Then corporate profits might be artificially increased. But on the other hand, what usually happens in such cases is that you impose limits on selling prices, typically agricultural products, other products of first necessity such as gas, coal, and so on. And then, of course, it becomes unprofitable to produce these goods anymore. So companies stop producing, or at least the marginal production plans are closed down. So as a consequence, you have a general impoverishment of the population and difficulties for all companies that depend on such goods. And that's exactly what we observed after 1972. The reduction of production was one of the causes spurring an increase of the price level within the United States, but also other countries. So this lies ahead for us too. I don't think the danger right now is very strong for this to happen, because there seems to be no consensus on the necessity of price controls. Right now, there's just a lot of bad-mouthing of businessmen, precisely for the reason that you pointed out, namely to deflect attention from the true culprit, namely from our monetary policy. Now, for me, the amazing thing, the true question, is not how inflation can be so strong right now, but the truly interesting question is, why did it take us so long for inflation to reach this dimension? Because our monetary policy has been fairly expansionary all throughout the period ever since the introduction of paper money in 1971. We had a very strong inflation in the 1970s, and then the Federal Reserve chairman at the time, Paul Volcker, slammed on the brakes, so he increased interest rates, thereby slowing down the expansion of the money supply. So there was a short break for a few years, but thereafter the expansionary policy resumed and accelerated all throughout the late 1980s, all throughout the 1990s, and even throughout the past decade. So the question is, well, how is it possible that we get inflation only now? Why wasn't it stronger before? And I think here a particular historical contingency comes into play, a particular historical circumstance that existed during the 1980s and 1990s, and that explains why prices have been relatively stable during this period. Here we have, first of all, financial and commercial deregulation setting in the 1980s. We should not forget that these were the Reagan years and the Thatcher years, and despite everything critical that we have to annotate about these years, one thing is true, that financial markets became more flexible, commerce became more free, and so the division of labor on an international scale increased, and because production therefore was boosted, there was a pressure on the price level. Prices, due to competition of entrepreneurs and due to free markets, were reduced and therefore partially compensated the increasing influence coming from the monetary policy. Then in the 1990s, the same thing happened again on an even larger scale, because suddenly the Soviet Union collapsed and all of the Eastern world, which before was a universe apart, joined the world economy. So suddenly we have an enormous increase of the division of labor, and the same factors therefore played again, compensating and even neutralizing sometimes the effects of the monetary policy. So what this means is that without these accidental or extraordinary circumstances, we would have had a more or less important decrease of the price level throughout the 1980s and 1990s, which would not have been a priori, from the outside, a bad thing, would have been rather good for the economy. But so as things were, the price level was relatively stable under the double impact of an increasing monetary supply, money supply, which tended to increase it, and increased production and the division of labor, which tended to decrease it. Now, in the past 5 or 10 years, these special forces have had their way, and they are no longer playing as much as before. So therefore, now the impact of monetary policy is increasingly felt more directly. And therefore, we no longer have this rescue belt that existed during the 1980s and 1990s, but rather we will feel now inflation more or less directly, more or less immediately following an expensive monetary policy. Last year, we had the beginning of the financial crisis, first in the subprime market and then spreading through the rest of the financial markets. And it was the reaction of the central banks was to increase the money supply in cooperation, was advertised as a big achievement of international politics. First statement was issued in December 2007 to this effect, and then followed by subsequent statements declaring the importance and the reality of cooperation between the central banks. Well, what this means in plain language is that central banks have decided to increase their money supplies in cooperation together with one another in order to, and the purpose is to prevent violent swings of the exchange rate, in particular between the euro and the dollar and the euro and the yen and so on. And as a consequence, now 9 months later, we are, and 12 months later, we are already feeling a strong increase of the price level. And all I can tell you is that this is not the end of the story. It will be even more important in the months to come.
Well, thank you, Federal Reserve. Thank you, federal government. Thank you, Bank of England and Bank of Germany and Bank of France and all these institutions of inflation all across the Western world. Thank you, Dr. Guido Holzman, for helping explain it to us.
It's a pleasure, Lou.
You've been listening to The Lou Rockwell Show. Produced by LouRockwell.com, the best-read libertarian website in the world. If you'd like to advertise on this podcast or on the website, email advertise@lourockwell.com. And thanks for listening.